This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
From my end of it, the performance end of it, and the production end of it, and the shooting of television and film and creating that sort of art, we believe every single person, it's the writing, it's the performances, it's the direction. You have to combine all those with the performances to say every single person we meet in this show is there isn't a wrong note. It's easy for you to suspend your disbelief that you're watching a television show. Every moment of that experience is believable and real and contributes to telling a story about an entire city or about an entire police department or a criminal organization.
Hello, I'm Dave.
And I'm Kobe.
And this is The Wire Stripped. It's the podcast where we watch The Wire and we talk about The Wire and we talk to people that made The Wire and we talk to the people that love The Wire. And if that's you, then you can chat to us. We'd love to chat to you at The Wire Stripped on Twitter or Instagram, or email us burner@thewirestripped.com.
Yes, and without further ado, let's get to myself and Dave talking about this episode, A New Day,
when you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon. Walk the straight and narrow track. When you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. Just gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. He got the fire and the fury.
Hello, Kobe.
Hi, Dave. Are you right?
I'm all right. Yeah, we are parked here outside Bubbles' garage, just waiting for the shop to open. Gonna get some whiteys.
I kind of got the impression that it's always like a 24/7 kind of establishment, but you're probably right.
He's got shift work. He's working in shifts.
Yeah, he wants to make sure he gets some sleep.
I think he's had to downgrade since Sherrod left.
Oh, but there is. Speaking of the guy, that's Sherrod right there.
Oh, there he is. He's back.
Oh, brilliant.
Well, I gotta say. Very pleased with this scene.
It is. I am.
It's lovely to see Sherrod back, but lovely to see Bubbles so welcoming and warm and enthusiastic.
Yeah, it's been. Bubbles needs an injured bird to help them out. We had Johnny Weeks.
Yeah.
Now we've got Sherrod, and without Sherrod, he felt kind of.
Well, Bubbles has a lot to give. He's a mentor figure.
He
right?
is.
Yeah.
And a mother figure. A caring parental figure.
Or a pretend uncle.
Pretend uncle.
I think
I still love that scene.
It's lovely seeing Bubbles with purpose and motivation, though. And I think this is a different Bubbles we get in this whole season, mm-hmm. isn't it? Right? He's driven and, your heart breaks.
Shit wasn't working out with JoJo and her. Said I wanted some chat on some shit some other boy did. I didn't want to make no noise on that, though.
Impressive. You know, you get with me and we pay him right back, okay?
Nah, that shit you've been saying been going through my head.
Forget about that. Forget about all that. If I wouldn't have pushed you off, you would have never been up on that corner.
But everything I do, I'd be fucking up. Whole time it feel like it wasn't me on that corner. I just wanted to get away.
Well, you're here now, ain't you? Right? This is you, right here, right now. Okay?
Burning a hole in that shit.
Fuck me all up when I saw you walking through the door, sure. Oh, shit. What do you think, huh? You know, I could have fights for this. All right, take your hat off, man. Don't burn them pimp steaks, huh?
So I guess following on from another incidental bit, the reason we're kind of starting off with the smaller pieces here, because this is a big episode for one of our characters. I'm sure we'll hear a lot from Maestro Harel in this episode, but let's just head to Omar briefly, because one of the things he does great, as well as being a stick up guy, he's good at just being a great detective and stakeout. There. He is.
Yeah, Ronaldo doesn't like the stakeouts.
He cannot be bothered.
No,
can he?
He's got no patience.
Do you reckon? I have not seen any Cheez-Its.
Oh, you're right.
Whatsos, whatever they're called. I've not seen any of that. Omar is...
That's not a proper stakeout at all.
It's not. No, it...
Bunny took the kids for a stakeout. The last episode.
Bum, bum, bum.
Thank you. This has been The Wire Strip. Good night, everyone.
But Omar does good stakeout. He does.
But that's why he's so good at being a stick-up guy, because he... Like most things in the world, it's all about intel, right?
It is.
Knowledge is power. And Omar spends time and patience sussing out his targets, finding out who's connected to. And he spends so much time tracing Slim Charles that he starts to piece together that he's connected with Prop Joe, that he knows where the New Day Co-op is.
Yeah.
He's really on the ball, yeah.
One of my favorite things is when Omar goes, "Hey now." And that's like penny dropping.
Like, yeah.
A big piece of the jigsaw puzzle has just landed, and he knows like infinite more than before the "Hey Now." But yeah, he's following Omar. Sorry, Omar's following the New Day Co-op, unknowns to him until that "Hey Now" piece, until the big piece falls. And then he decides to visit Prop Joe to work out what's going on.
In a bit more. Cracking scene.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Have we had Prop Joe and... Yeah, because through Butchie.
We saw them at... Well, this is where Omar's figured more pieces out, right? Because he realizes in that scene that Prop Joe sent him in to rob Marlo, knowing full well who Marlo was, right? So Omar does not like to be manipulated, and he's using that same decision by Prop Joe as now leverage, because he's saying, "I'll tell Marlo that you sent me in to rob him in the card game." He's using that to play Prop Joe's own game to try and get Prop Joe to help him rob Marlo again. So it's kind of like, it is just several levels of heist happening here.
Michael K. Williams, obviously, yes, he was amazingly talented.
This is Eric Deggans. He's the NPR TV critic.
But he was also like his rise to prominence as a result of being on The Wire was a good example of why The Wire was as successful as it was. He came to TV acting in an unconventional way. He had been a backup dancer for artists like Madonna and George Michael, and he'd been in videos. But there wasn't really a sense that he could be an actor. And, you know, of course, he had a huge scar down his face. And so he wasn't the conventional kind of looking actor, even for black actors. And back then, you know, African-American actors especially, I don't know what it was like in England, but in America, it was harder for black actors to get high-profile TV jobs because the TV networks were hesitant to put on shows that had too many non-white characters in them. I talked to David Simon about this right before I wrote the piece for the BBC, and he said one reason why The Wire had so many great actors like Michael K. Williams and Michael B. Jordan and Clark Peters and, you know, Wendell Pierce and, you know, on and on and on, you know, Clark Johnson, you know, all these great guys, all these great actors and actresses, was because, you know, they weren't working as much as they should have been because, you know, more conventional TV shows weren't hiring them.
That was all Michael K. Williams. Like, when you watch him in other things, there's just this, I don't know, there's something about him that you can't take your eyes off of him. You believe.
This is Jennifer Wood. She's the editor of Mental Floss and of the book The Curious Viewer.
He brings a soul to his characters that few actors can really accomplish. And, you know, he was complex, but at the same time, not really. It was just sort of, he was straightforward and that, like, here's who I am, you know, here's the character I am. And it was, it's hard to imagine the show without him. And, you know, sort of what it, there's 100 other characters on it, but to stand out so strongly in a cast made up of that caliber, you know, actors and characters, is a pretty amazing thing.
On the politics side, we're starting to see the fallout from Herc busting a reverend for drugs, and that this puts, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, ripples down the, you know, down the chain from the authority figures on top. But this, yeah, is one of the reverse things where somebody at the bottom has done something and we're seeing it affect Carchetti's basically in a tricky position now, because he needs to either introduce a civilian review board for police complaints, which mm-hmm. won't be popular with the what does he call them, the frontline troops, the beat officers and all that. But if he lets this go away without somebody getting fired or severe consequences, well, then he's alienated the minister's community, right? Yep. Right, justifiably so. So it's kind of he doesn't know what to do, and this is one of his first. He describes it as his first bowl of shit, which I liked. Which
yeah,
a nice call back to his meeting with a former mayor.
Yeah, that was good. That was a good scene with that former mayor. And again, just Herc's nonsense rippling through this episode.
Herc, shit rolls downhill, but Herc managed to roll the shit back uphill. But the who is Carchetti's unexpected savior? It's Burrell, right? Who literally throws the book at him.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
this is how to sort your shit out. Hold on, does this mean Burrell? This is what Burrell wanted, do you think?
I think Burrell saw an opportunity here.
Okay, yeah. He just thought.
Oh, you mean with all the arrests?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think
that something was actually going to go wrong at some point, that Carchetti would have to get himself out of it and think?
Oh my God, maybe I hadn't thought about that.
Maybe Burrell is smarter.
Is he that much of a genius?
By knowing Frankie for years, I always sort of felt like Frankie knew what I was doing.
Sheed, it's Isaiah Whitlock Jr., Clay Davis himself.
He wasn't going to rat me out or anything like that, but he knew, because that's some of that comes out in my everyday personality, you know, where, you know, you're gonna turn on some charm and you're gonna try to be as charming as you possibly can, even though you're not quite on the up and up. But as far as, you know, his character, we were all trying to do the best. I mean, every character on that show was flawed to a point where, you know, it was so believable. And we're all out there in this sort of maze trying to do our best and believing that... you know, we're doing great things.
So we talked about Carchetti eating his bowl of shit, his first bowl of shit. And then this actually turns into quite a humorous section where he just steps into the Parks and Rec department and says, right, a swing's broken. And then...
Oh, and I love this montage.
He storms out and they're like, which swing? And then, and then he storms into the department. Guys, there's a fire hydrant that needs to be... that needs to be locked off. Which one? And they all just dive out because the mayor elect has just come in, said something's wrong, and they all step up the game. And again, being a force of good here, Carchetti, and seeing that he can actually affect change.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this.
Mm.
But I also did appreciate all their frustration when your boss comes in, gives you an impossible brief with no details. And he'd be like, I need that by tomorrow. So we get some nice scenes of Daniels enjoying his newfound position here, right?
Well, why wouldn't you?
So he's in homicide, and he's basically like, what do you guys want? And we get some, as always, a lot of humor from the homicide, black humor from the homicide people.
Those guys are great.
They want, you know, more investment in lab work and and technicians, improved witness protection, and a pay raise, right? So a lot of this sort of...
But thing. I thought the homicide detectives were quite happy with their pay because they get all the overtime, aren't they, and stuff, so...
Yeah, but they're still sort of... I think the homicide workers still come across as these sort of blue-collar worker sort of vibe, right? They're always seen underpaid, and they probably are underpaid.
Yeah.
Plus, if the new boss is there, you always ask for more money.
Sure, why not?
but this kind of alludes to the title as well of this episode, A New Day, right? This is a new day. You got the New Day Co-op.
Yeah.
But you've also got a new day in the Western and in homicide, thanks to Cedric Daniels.
And, I mean, one of the ways he enacts that is to have a chat with Freeman.
Oh, yes. This is when you're like, yes, the pieces are coming together.
Daniel's on one side of the desk, Lester Freeman's on the other side, and they're talking. And that's where magic starts to happen.
Yeah, we love these characters so much because we've spent so much time with them.
Yeah.
Right? There's a great... So this is basically, Daniel's telling Freeman he wants him back on the MCU. But Freeman's been burned by Marimo, and Ben gets basically told by Daniels, which I love, like, you can pick your commanding officer, basically. Like, as far as I'm concerned, you are Major Crimes. And I just love that. He's just like, Freeman being recognized for the genius that he is, and Daniels using his power and influence for good. These are two brilliant things.
I love that straight away we go back into the MCU offsite and... Freeman goes back into case files.
Yes. Oh, because earlier in the previous episode, we'd seen Marimo just sort of frustratedly get more letters from stupid Lester Freeman, stupid subpoenas. And then you're like, no, you fucking idiot.
It's important.
And I love in this episode, they cut, you know, we get Freeman, as you say, like switching the lights back on and walking around. It's such an awesome moment. Mm. And he takes out his old boxes and he's looking through the subpoenas. But they cut that so beautifully in this episode with the people who he was subpoenaing at a fundraiser with Carchetti for the Ella Thompson Fund.
The Ella Thompson Fund. Guys, if you follow us on Patreon, you can help. The Ella Thompson Fund is a real charity, as you've probably heard about, because we've been banging about it for the past season and this one. This is a nice super tie-in.
It was great to see to see them in the actual, because it's the first time around, I didn't know who they were.
But
they were like celebrities popping up on the banner when I saw it.
So that is nice, because you just pulls out the case file, it's like Jeff Smith, and then suddenly the name
cut
tag.
Jeff Smith, yeah, I love that.
It's a really nice touch. Probably something I missed in the first few times watching it, certainly. Which is why you want to rewatch The Wire time and time again. And then listen to this podcast and then tell your friends about it. Give us a review on Spotify.
Then follow us on Patreon.
Yep.
Help the Ella Thompson Fund.
Yes, it's all good.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
So we have the culmination of Carchetti's nuisance with all the heads of the Parks and Rec team.
They all report back, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And only one team has done a good job.
Yeah.
Which is again great. Then it's that stick for the other guys to do better next time, isn't it?
Exactly.
I like his style.
But we get an interesting bit at the end of that scene where that one guy stays back and informs Carchetti that there's a $54 million deficit in the school system, and that is when you just despair, right?
Well, my heart dropped for him there. My heart dropped for the kids of Baltimore.
Not just for him. Yeah, it's the kid, because that's just the genius of this show. We have been watching those kids and Prez and Bunny battle away on the front lines. Even Cutty was there at one point, you know, rounding kids up, and you're just like, what are they going to do? And then one tiny throwaway line from a character we've never met before, $54 million, and you're just like, suddenly the odds are just insurmountable, aren't they?
It's insane. I, like I say, my heart just sank for a lot of different reasons, a lot of different people. It seems like a Sisyphean task, really.
Yeah, I mean, how do you do that? We certainly don't know, but send your answers to producers at thewirestripped.com.
You know, we will pass off your ideas as our own, and we'll make millions.
We will fix the school system.
Should we head to the schools?
Well, we're here, so let's talk about the schools.
Mr. Mayor, on my way downtown today, I saw an abandoned car. Tow it right away.
Where is Mr. Mayor? The location. Oh, fucking Christ. Call Transpo, get the fucking trucks moving.
Mr. Mayor.
I got a constituent call. She said the playground near her house was a hazard, rusted metal.
We'll get right on it. The location? Sir, I need a location.
Mr. Mayor, I understand your concern, but you've got to understand. We have more than 9,100 hydrants.
And one of them's leaking.
You see a lot of people talking about the curriculum, and especially I love the way it's counterpointed with Carchetti in the mayor's office. And they talk about what they need to do for the schools, but they never talk about the relationships. They never talk about, they're just talking about like grades, assessment results, money.
This is Peter Tobin. He's a teacher and an educational content writer who's worked in schools in the UK and in Ireland.
Like, I've worked in great schools where they've had money pumped into them, top of the range, computer suites, everything. But that does nothing for behavior in your classroom. You can still be abused in a classroom with 30 computers. You can still have things thrown at you as a teacher. Like, the money doesn't fix things. There's lots of other issues going on around it that's kind of swirling around it. But they're kind of, I love the fact that the depiction of the classroom and the environment for the kids is so raw and real. And then the depiction of what's happening in politics is totally ignorant of that. Totally ignorant.
Right. So, we're talking about the schools. So let's stay with the schools. We check in with Bunny's special class, as
Bunny's
you call it.
Bunny's special class. we need a jingle for that.
I think that would have been an interesting spin-off show.
It would have been.
Yeah, but like a heartwarming sort of sitcom vibe.
It would definitely have canned laughter.
Yeah.
I'm already imagining like a BoJack Horseman type. Bunny walks in. Bunny! we get some. I've never done any of these trustful things. Where you have to pretend you trust. Well, not pretend. Show that you have trust in your fellow.
Right.
In your fellow person.
Turn around. Close your eyes. Oh no!
Oh, that's Dave.
Very convincing. You're supposed to catch me. Scream.
It's a kind of a Simpsons Homer Simpson scream.
That was very Homer Simpson. No, I've never done it either. But I thought interesting. Another interesting example of the Bunny's special class trying to sort of break down their barriers and make them work together. But we see Albert is not into any of this, young Albert.
But that's not, I mean, that's not necessarily anything that you'd take note of. Just before we go to talking about Albert, one thing I liked in this was that no one wanted to do it. And then someone suggested that Naaman does it, and Naaman's like, no man. But then, because now him and Bunny have got that connection, Bunny just gives him a little side eye.
Yeah,
mate, come on.
Naaman is the star. He's the star pupil of this class.
He is,
right? And that's what I love about it. It's like that this Naaman is the reason, you know, we spoke in the last episode about the assessment and it didn't go well, and how do you measure performance and success in this class? But he is the measure of success. He is thriving in this environment. He's, because he is just such a nice and charming person. Like Bunny is reaching him. They formed a bond. It's making Naaman's life better. He's a better influence than his mother. It's doing all the things that Bunny and the team want it to do, but nobody is seeing that except us.
No, exactly.
And we are the audience from the future.
We're seeing, we're seeing them grow and blossom. It's a lovely bit there. But let's go back to Albert. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh God. So Albert's had some tragic news. Oh my God. This kid actor is phenomenal in this scene. It's so sad. But his mother has died, and this is just another, example of just the people on the front line suffering.
There's one of the teachers who I think in the TV show is painted as a little bit of a stick in the mud. I think she might be from the kind of the state education board or something. And she says, you know, you're accepting that these kids are failures. Like you're lowering your expectations for them by removing them from the classroom. And Bonnie says, well, they can't, they're not going to, you know, you could leave them in the classroom and they're never going to pass the test or achieve or do anything. And that may be the case, yes. But in some ways she's right, because lowering your expectations for students because they sell drugs or because they swear at teachers or whatever it is, it kind of feeds into this vicious cycle then, because expectations are always being lowered for them. And that feeds in. And then when they meet challenges, like you see another really, really great kind of representation of what kids are like in classrooms is once they face any sort of challenges, that's when the challenge behavior comes out. So, you know, when Bunny is talking to Naaman and he's asking him uncomfortable questions and he's like, well, fuck you. And he says it over and over. And there's that really harrowing bit with Albert where when they ask if any of the kids want to, in that little small room, the small group, the teacher asks if any of the kids want to, I think, do the trust fall. They want to stand up and fall back into the arms of the others. And she says, well, what about you, Albert? And he stands up and he starts swearing at her and storms out of the room. And this is like right towards the end of the season. And she says, you know, what's the problem? I thought you'd been making such good progress. And in another room then with Bunny and somebody else, he says that his mum has died and he's still coming to school. And like these things happen. It's not drama for, you know, a TV show. These things really happen.
But there is a rumor going around outside of Bunny's special class in the wider school that Randy is a snitch, and word is traveling fast, as it does in schools. We went to school,
and so this is before this. As they are experiencing this is before everyone had a mobile phone.
Oh my god, can you imagine the WhatsApp groups?
Yeah,
the memes.
Year 5 WhatsApp group.
Oh no,
Randy's
yeah.
a snitch. And that'll be it. Like everyone gets it straight away.
GIFs going around.
You see it in some films sometimes where everyone gets the group message and everyone just like stops in their tracks, looks at the message, looks at the person.
Yeah.
And then like chaos ensues.
Oh my God, that's awful, because he would be experiencing this bullying, you know,
offline
through his phone as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you feel Randy's isolation, right? Nobody's sitting with him. People are moving away from him. He's getting, you know, called a snitch in the corridor. And then it culminates in him being attacked outside school. And you just got to love Michael in this moment, right? He stands up for his friend.
Loving it. Michael gets a bloody mouth and he is smiling from ear to ear.
Yeah.
As a result of this little ruckus.
Well, there's an anger in Michael that has been seething for a long time, right? Yeah. And this is a release for him.
No, we saw. You said he had a sly demeanor last episode, after he ordered the assassination of his Bug's dad, and this is maybe a chance for him to get some of his own aggression out in this case.
Yeah. Well, there's a change. Well, let's stay on Michael for a second, just while we're talking about him, because there is a change in him in this episode, you know, and we see that in the way he escalates their plan against Officer Walker, which we'll chat about in a second. But Michael brings it to the next level, right? He brings a gun. Michael is different after what has happened, his encounter with Chris and Snoop, and he's entering into a different phase of himself and his in a different world, and it's not kind, it's not really nice to watch. And you're right, this is reflective of it. There's a gleefulness in the violence for him.
And also respect to Dookie, who are running and getting Prez.
Getting help, yeah.
And much respect for Prez for just stepping straight in there.
Yeah.
Because these kids are not much smaller than him, if at all.
Yeah.
And could be carrying weapons and, yeah, but Prez just knew what to do.
That's what's so good about this. Like, everyone in that moment acted exactly like you would expect their characters to act.
Yeah.
Right, and all in very different ways.
And it's so sad to see at the end, you know, Randy's on the floor.
Oh, I know, and he's not moving.
He's in pieces.
Yeah.
Mate. Randy's got one of the best smiles on TV, generally, and when he's not smiling, you know something's wrong.
It's so sad.
It's terrible.
And Prez is as angry as we are.
Yeah.
And he takes it to Carver, who then takes it to Bunny.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to see all the pieces being connected, right? All the pieces matter. It's lovely.
Oh, him snitch bitch, all that. It was, I completely understood. You know, like, you know, from day one, there's no snitching. Also, Cameron and the diplomats were huge at this time. So we really knew, you know, snitching is not what you do.
You're listening to Maestro Harrell, who played Randy Wagstaff.
I do think looking back on it is funny because I also knew I was acting. So I never had I understood what it meant in the world of what it means. But I think at the end of the day, it was also like being like, yeah, like, you know, no one wants to be the snitch. Well, going back to also being like, man, once you saw that happen, it was like, yeah, it'd be really cool to be Roman Reigns. You know what I mean? Or, man, what's Michael up to? Damn, I wish I had got that role. But once you start seeing, like, I'm so grateful too because I was able to clothe that character because it allowed me to, like, it really gave me some really, really meaty moments. You know what I mean? And moments that, like, I know, like, even hopefully throughout my career, like, it's still some things people will reference, you know? But it's, yeah, I do think the snitching thing, I mean, to this day, there's people who will see me and be like, hey, you that snitching nigga off the wire. And I'm just like, yeah, his name is Randy, but thanks, bro. Like, man, why you got to tell a dog like that? Like, I get that all the time.
Yeah, definitely. And Prez represented Ed Burns.
This is, of course, the man himself, Chad Coleman, who played Cutty on The Wire.
You know? Ed Burns is a godsend in the community, man. You know, and that there and again, because I'm going to show you that you can transcend the ignorance of race. And I'm going to show you my heart, and I'm going to show you my commitment, and I'm going to be here for you every day. And he was a police officer. I think the greatest teacher ever should be police officers who become teachers. That's the real, that's the myth. But you know what I'm saying? In the hood, the police officer who becomes a teacher is so powerful because all those relationships, you know, and Ed carried himself in the hood. And, you know, when you carry yourself in the right way as a police officer in the hood, you're getting nothing but respect. And Melvin, you know, Melvin said that of him, that man never planted nothing on me, and that man was a very fair person.
Well, let's take a step back. You're talking about Michael escalating the situation with Walker. And just to recap, in the previous episode, Walker had chased down Donut, broken lots of his fingers, and as the guys are friends, they didn't like that. And as
yeah, fair enough.
And yeah, why not?
So they want revenge.
Good.
Yeah.
I love it.
And but again, this was interesting to me because what are we 10 11 we're 11 episodes in, right? This is episode 11, and this felt like it really, so we're nearly at the end of the show this season, and this felt like an interesting, like, I'm going to say juxtaposition now because I'm in English English lesson mode. So there's this whole series of events is an interesting, like, juxtaposition to the first episode, Boys of Summer, when we saw the boys with their hijinks and their water balloons and their pranks, they're hatching plans, right? And it's the kind of, it's a similar mode here,
yeah,
but with a really dark edge.
With menace there.
And this is, shows you how much things have changed in all of these boys' lives. First of all, it's yeah, Dookie was kind of half attacked in that first episode of Boys of Summer. Here, you know, Donuts got, sitting there on the stoop with broken fingers at the behest of this officer. And then the plan, while it's still got that boyish charm, like cover someone in paint, right? That's very Boys of Summer.
That someone is a police officer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That this shit has escalated. It's a police officer who they're holding at gunpoint.
Yes.
So.
And then they rob him as well.
Yeah. Oh, the ring. Yeah. We don't talk about the ring a lot, but the ring. I love how the ring is traveling.
It's traveling through
around
people,
the world, yeah. Around the Baltimore.
And you're right. It is. An escalation, and Naaman sees the fear in that. He's got like genuine concerns about, dude, whoa.
And Naaman's the wild card, and had been in episode one, and has been throughout the season. Michael is crossing a line that Naaman is unwilling to cross and won't.
Yeah.
And isn't able to.
He's not able to.
No.
He hasn't got the heart, if that's the right terminology. And the one thing I'd like to say at this point is, the guys then are talking about little Kevin being killed. And yeah. Randy, at this point, is like...
worried.
He's rightly worried.
Yeah, understandably. Yeah.
And little Kevin's been killed for potentially being a snitch, even though that's not confirmed. And this is, you know... the weight of the world on this kid is honestly, like... Again, my heart is breaking right now thinking about it. Oh, mate.
But Maestro plays it so beautifully as well. I mean, all of these kids in this, when you look at it, this season as a whole, and as we say again, you compare where they started to where they are now. They all did such an incredible job. Just hats off to the casting in this show again.
Yeah.
Well, the whole Randy thing, and the way he has been let down by the police, you know, is coming to a head here. So we see Prez, the Wire's so good at these chain reactions, right?
Yes.
So Randy gets beaten up, yep. Prez...
Finds out why,
brings it to Carver, says, yep. What the fuck, man, he was in your care. Carver's like, whoa, what happened, Herc, what you were supposed to tell Bunk.
Yeah.
And then Bunk's like, oh, Herc, and then it all comes back to Herc saying... It always Herc is like, fuck Bunk. And he didn't make the call, right, that time. So Bunk is now on the case, and now we're seeing a chain reaction.
Don't want an angry Bunk.
Way.
No.
And so they, you know, speak to Carver. I mean, we get this great little MCU reunion in the school.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Lester Bunk and Prez. Again, it's like you say, it's a great reunion. It's like the opposite. It's like... the other side of Lester and Daniel's talking with these three guys talking. Well, with Lester and Prez together for the first time in ages.
I know, yeah. Even Bunk's like, you know, yeah. You guys are getting all emotional.
Yeah, exactly.
It's lovely. But Prez, what's interesting here is that Prez tells them back off. Right, he's advising Randy not to cooperate with the police, right? And he's a former policeman.
He knows exactly the danger that Randy's in at this point. And that danger is very real. He's seen it in the smallish way in the front on the steps of the school.
Yeah.
But he knows where this could easily, very, very easily end up for this guy who's got nothing but good in his nature. He wants to sell candy to kids, just to make a bit of money on the side.
But there's one extra vital chain that happens, because Prez says he's not helping them and he's going to tell Randy not to help them, but he gives them just that tiny bit of information about what Randy told, or what little Kev asked Randy to tell, what's his name, who died? That Bunk's tried. Lex, thank you.
Yeah.
My God, guys, it's late. What he was told him to do, which was go to a very specific playground that we then cut to Lester and Bunk sniffing around that same playground, being all silent and detective-y.
I love the scene so much. This is the like the yin to the fuck scene yang, where there's no
yes
there's yeah. very few, there's very 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 little dialogue, apart from Lester just being the world's greatest detective, which isn't Batman, it seems, it's Lester Freeman.
Of course, it's Lester Freeman.
This is what one of the things I love about The Wire is that denouement is the payoff from the first scene where we see Snoop buying that nail gun, Lester realizing that there's a nail gun, that the vacants have very floppy doors, they can rip them off, but these ones that have these brand new nail gun nails is where the dead bodies are kept. And
there is no dialogue until he announces it, like he's cracked the case.
No, there's no dialogue until Bunk says, Lester, you're scaring me now.
That's so good.
And then Lester finishes off in a great line, "This is a tomb." Lex is in there. Doesn't even walk in there. Doesn't even check in.
Walks away like a badass. It is so good. I'm with you. God, I love this show.
Thank you very much for listening to that episode, guys. Join us next time for episode 12, That's Got His Own, which will be out in the next week. Before we go, of course, we want to say a few thank yous to the key people who helped us make this podcast. First of all, Sam and Martin from the Song by Song podcast for this version of Way Down and Hole that you're listening to right now.
And a thank you to Michael Balestrieri at Black Snow Comics on Instagram, who did our lovely season 4 artwork.
Yeah, thanks, of course, to Tom Wally, who produces, edits, and exec produces this podcast and fact checks us when we get it wrong, which can happen, does happen, a lot of the time.
Never. I've never gotten anything wrong in my entire life. OB Joshua is our producer, and he's the man that brings all these interviews and clips together and helps make this show sound so good. So thanks, OB. And lastly, our transcription software is Sonics. And if you want to get 100 minutes free of transcription, then you can do it at Sonics, sonix.ai/invite/script.
Okay, guys, thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.